This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Good afternoon, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul. And I'm your HedgeGhoul master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland Magazine. And if you're not already subscribers, you can talk to Helen outside in the hallway, who has the latest issue there, hot off the presses. Now, this HedgeGhoul is being held in conjunction with the exhibition, which will shortly open, the 14th of December. 14th of December in the Coach House. Entitled 100 Years of Women in Politics and Public Life. Now, just to explain, setting up the exhibition was delayed, but we had booked this date and this venue, so we decided to go ahead with the HedgeGhoul, having assembled this stellar panel here in front of you. Some of these people are very difficult to find. This is actually Jolie here beside me, not a hologram. We're delighted to have them all. I'll introduce in a few minutes. But I think that most of you have had Sinead's presentation, so I think it's the only thing Sinead is, they might go to the exhibition now. I haven't heard your presentation. But anyway, I'll introduce the panel. We have Sinead McCool, the curator of the exhibition, and beside me, Mary O'Rourke, former Minister for Education. Of course, Mary is one of the Lennon family dynasty from Athlone. You're not the first Lennon I've had on the panel, by the way, on a high school panel. I had Connor on a discussion a few years ago. Yes, your nephew. Yeah. And then beside me here, the elusive Joe Lee, formerly of New York University. You're tired now, Joe, are you?
Oh, what do you mean elusive?
Are you ever? I never get you on the phone, that's why. I also have to talk to your wife. And then finally,
she organised me.
Yes, she's the real person you need to talk to. And then we've Deirdre McMahona, who's the president of the History Teachers Association of Ireland. Now, just to explain the format of the HedgeGhoul, it is a school. You have to pay attention. You have to keep order, and you have to do a little bit of work as well, because we will be expecting members of the audience to make their own contribution from the floor, and it won't be just at the end. If at any stage you disagree violently with something said at the podium here, put the paw up, and we will respond and make your contribution to the discussion. This, of course, the reason we're having this exhibition and this HedgeGhoul is because this is the centenary of women getting the vote, women over 30, at least, getting the vote in the 1918 general election. Now, of course, famously, Countess Markowitz was the first woman elected to Westminster. But, of course, she never took her seat because she was a member of the first Dáil, which assembled in January 1919 in the round room at the back of the Mansion House. And she was not only the first minister in the first Dáil, she was Minister for Labour. Sinead, we don't hear that much about her performance as Minister for Labour. Normally we think of Candice Markowitz as an iconic figure. How did she fare as Minister for Labour? Now, given the fact that she was Minister for Labour on the run, more or less.
I think there's been a lot of revision in relation to the Countess Markowitz in recent years, in that maybe a more serious study. So in the Countess Markowitz School that was set up a number of years ago, they've actually asked every year that they would have a keynote address just related to the Countess and her contribution. And a number of years ago, it's published in a book of proceedings that Margaret Ward was asked to address this very issue, and everyone would be very familiar with Margaret Ward's stellar work from the time of unmanned revolutionaries. And, she looks at it not at the sort of rhetoric. I mean, you hear that story often about how, she settled one dispute by brandishing a gun in terms of that was how she resolved the dispute. And you often have to look at where the source of that material was coming from, because she got so much bad press. She's almost like the star and the sun in relation to way that she's always depicted. And when you take away all of those sort of mad stories away from it, she did set up arbitration courts. She did try and put a structure on her role, but she was very conscious that she was trying to balance between the trade unions and what the trade unions were doing at the time, and establishing a Secretary of Labour within a new government. And then, of course, if you have her being on the run and being jailed during that period of time, which is obviously really, really difficult. But she was one of the people who didn't have her offices raided. She actually had it set up in such a way that it looked like a music school. There were pianos in the space and that at the time. time. And what I think about it is that the idea of the paperwork. Where is the paperwork to show what they actually achieved? That is the problem, that you don't have that bundle of documentation that backs up that work. But I still don't give up hope that material is going to come to light. I think that's the one thing we've discovered over the last sort of 20 years, is never give up on the fact that you'll get more documentation to prove a particular point. You just have to keep highlighting it. And I think we've moved from her being the caricature into a serious player in the most recent interpretations of her.
Joe, can I go to you on this one? Because you produced your Ireland, 1912 to 1985, was that the final? And you did take a bit of flack at the time. You mentioned, I think Margaret Ward actually was the person who was critical of the lack of the women's presence in that. But then Sinead maybe has given you an out here, right? It's the lack of documentation. How can historians deal with that? Right? In other words, how can you study something that's in one sense that's not there, the documents aren't there, but the phenomenon is there of women's activity, women's political activity?
Well, I think that applies to everybody, basically. You know, if the documentation isn't there, the historian by historian can't say, footnote it, etc., this is the way it was. You can surmise, but your surmise is always subject to qualification and to revision and all the rest of it. You may have surmised enough, maybe far more than you surmised, or there may be nothing to surmise. So you can only go as far as documentation allows you. You can suggest possibilities, it seems to me, or reasonable possibilities, or within the balance of possibilities, or even the balance of probabilities. But you can't say this is the way it was if you don't have the actual evidence in front of you. It's like a court of law in that respect. You know, you can't make a judgment on something that the evidence isn't there for. You can suggest what you think the balance of probabilities is, right? But then there's always a danger for that if you're writing as a historian in what I might call the narrow sense. Let's say you can't assert something as definite, or you can't even suggest that something is possible, but you can't suggest this is almost certainly the way it was, because that's going too far beyond your brief. So you may have very passionate feelings about it and how you would have loved it to have been, but if the stuff isn't there, you can't bloody well say it as if that was the case.
But I think it's the case now that the stuff is there now. And maybe I'll go to you on this one, Deirdre, because you're at the whole face as a teacher, right? I mean, I'm asking the question because I'm not quite clear. I'm not a school teacher. Is the material there now for students in terms of women's history and given its proper place?
Well, I think it is, thankfully. I mean, in one sense, I keep saying my mantra is that there's never been a more wonderful time to be a teacher and to be a student of history because of resources being made available. That's again through to the great work of Sinead et al. And other people who've been involved in the writing of history, and of course going back to the great champion of all would be Margaret McCurtain. And I think Margaret McCurtain, you know, single-handedly then, with the great support of her colleagues in the world of history, in publishing her very, very important book in 1970, I think, am I right there, Tommy, the book on...
1978. I think it's 78. 78, I think.
But basically sort of, started challenging the old certainties and started doing precisely what you're asking, is let's look at the evidence that's there. And of course, over time, evidence keeps, does reveal itself. But we just need insightful minds like Margaret and like contemporary historians as well. So in terms of what material is available to us as teachers, take something like the digital edition of the census. That, I mean, now all you need is one computer, and in fact some schools can boast many computers and computer rooms or whatever. That doesn't need to be that high tech, that now it literally, the press of a button, that one can look into to a century ago from all aspects, all based on sources, Joe, and the stuff is there. You cannot argue with the state papers. So now it's great to be a history teacher because of all of these now being made available through the various, as I say, good works and all of that. But certainly it was harder up until now.
Mary, can I just bring you in on this? When you started your political career, that was back in the 70s, I think?
82.
No, but you were local councillor before that.
Why? Yeah,
that's all politics is local,
as you know.
I'm just curious as to whether, were you conscious of this history behind you, like, of the Countess Markovitz, of all these people? Because when you started off, like, this wouldn't have been front and centre of...
No, you're quite right, it wouldn't have been. But I was always very conscious of Constance Markovich. My mother was born in a place called Drumcliff in County Sligo. So Liz Adele and all of what went on there, we were always kind of fed those stories when we were growing up. And in fact, when my mother had me, and you can imagine how many years ago that was, Brian was 7 years older, Paddy was 5 years older, my sister Anne was 5 years older, and I was the last. You know, Irish families, they always ended up having one more. And my mother called me Mary Constance, after Constance Markovich. And she called me Mary Constance Hannah. Hannah was after Hannah Sheedy Skeffington. So if she wasn't a Republican, who was? So I was very conscious that I was called Mary Constance after Constance Markovich. And in that way, I kind of... sort of, she grew into my mind. And I remember reading, and I wonder, perhaps I'm sure you could tell us, Sinead, if this is true, that there's a coat hanger in the House of Commons, yes, with the name of Constance Markovich on it. She never took up her place there, as we all know, that time, but her coat hanger was there with her name on it. And when I was years ago in London one time, I went to the House of Commons and I found her coat hanger. And I thought, well, now, Constance, there you are, and here I am. She never took up her place. But I wondered, and I'm sure maybe Deirdre or yourself, Sinead, or indeed Joe, how many women, that time we were called the British Isles, were not, thank God, anymore that. But in that time, how many women stood in that election?
It's 17 in some accounts, 16 or 17. It varies between the two.
It stood in the whole election.
Yeah, and actually it's really interesting. They had an exhibition on in London but they didn't address who those women were. And there's now going to be an exhibition in 2019 looking at those individual women, because so many people ask the question,
because I often wondered about those women.
Yeah.
But she was the only one that out of all those that got elected in the British Isles.
A lot of the women stood in No Hope constituencies, though. You know, unionist dominators in the north and so on.
Was Winnie Carney is the one you think about.
Yes,
that, and she had no hope of being elected. And then when it came time for selection, a lot of the women objected, including Hannah Sheedy Skeffington, did not want to stand and have no hope of being elected. They wanted to throw their lot behind.
The women who might have a chance to win.
So there was a great mobilisation in relation to the electioneering process. But what's interesting about that is when you think about it and you think about the fight for the vote, so from violence in the suffragettes, the fact that you then sort of, you know, shake your head and think that it is only the Countess who ends up being elected. And of course she had been involved in the suffrage movement in Sligo, in her own home place. And when you even read her earliest speech that's reported in the newspaper as sort of amusing proceedings, she's sort of saying, if we don't make a row and we don't make a noise, we won't be heard. And it's so interesting because continues on through the time.
It continued on forever in the time. So to answer you directly, yes, I was conscious, both from my mother's background and from the fact that she talked a lot about Liz Adele and the inhabitants there. So I was always very conscious of Constance Markovich.
Just want to make it clear that Mary did not tell me this before, and that was a totally lucky hit in my part.
Actually,
we have a radio mic at the back there. If you want to make a contribution, just wait till we have the radio mic, because this is being recorded, by the way. So just bear that in mind, by the way. You know, keep it clean. Could you just bring up the microphone here? Somebody wants to make a contribution.
Isn't there, is
where
she?
Where's she gone?
She's gone.
There she is. There. Yes. Just this lady here.
Thanks. Thanks very much. Just while you're on the topic of Countess Markovich, I would just like, maybe Sinead, you could address the fact of the recognition that you would have had at the time or after her death. I know she's become an iconic figure now, you could say, but given that she was the first MP and the first member of Dáil and the first minister. Did she get a state funeral, or was she a victim of... Right, just to establish that. Yeah. And was she, in your estimation, a victim of her class and a victim of... You know, she was often considered a drama figure, really. And I wonder, was that a form of misogyny?
Oh, of course. So that's a very complicated. What when Sean O'Fuelon brought out the first biography of her, it was very negative. And I think when you look at a lot of the material that was produced in that period, just in the middle of the 20s and into the early 30s, where you look at it, and this is something that's come out in relation to, you know, researching for this exhibition, I mightn't have answered this the same way maybe some years ago, but you look at the rise of all of these different organisations, from SARA or the Republican Congress to the Communist Party. There was a great fear among the people in established politics, and we were a very young nation at that stage, and so many of the women who had been active in 16 and onwards were taking part in these organisations. And you have to think about Maud Gonne and were constantly having these speeches on, in O'Connell Street and that. So when they were dealing with making of icons or the idea of iconic status, there was a deliberate effort to depict them in a way in a lot of what was written, so that seemed to be negative towards them. The interesting thing about the funeral of Countess Margaret, which I met someone recently who said that her mother had witnessed it and had counted the gun carriages with flowers, and that this child had counted and said there were 9 gun carriages full of flowers that followed the coffin. Mm. And I think that's a really good visual reference to, again, a tribute to a particular person. And what comes through over and over again from oral accounts to written accounts is that how she was loved by individuals, and how people who actually came in contact with her said that she was such a good person. Politically, it's a little bit more complicated because she's owned by so many different people. So from her original being in Sinn Féin, then Sinn Féin morphing and changing, then into Fianna Fáil, then into the early years of the state, where who did she represent and what did she say? And so I think that's where her legacy around how she's depicted is. It's like pick a countess. Yes, she was an actress. Yes, she was very dramatic in relation to how she kissed her gun, and that is a true story that was caricatured by Grace Gifford in the aftermath of the Rising. She is photographed and talked about in the press at the time. She did in 1917 dress up in the Sinn Féin uniform, and those photographs with Poppet, her dog, were distributed to the Tatler magazine. So she's actually producing her own publicity and her own propaganda, and at that time she was being put forward for that reason. That was the reason when she went to America, where she's fundraising. So she was playing a role in relation to gain funds or producing a following for what she believed in.
I think it's very interesting what you said, because what people will tell you that she was loved by ordinary people. You know, the way people say now, or she likes to be loved, or he likes to be. She was very much in touch with ordinary men and women, and I think that is at odds with the public exposition of her that we sometimes see, toting the gun and the uniform and all of that. She was a very ordinary woman.
Can I just go back to the 1918 election, because we may move on for a minute, and I want to go to Joe, to you on this one. Women got the vote for the first time in 1918, women over 30, and apparently the reason for that was that if they gave it at the same level as men, the women would have vastly outnumbered the men, because so many had been killed in the war. Now, the Irish Parliamentary Party, Redmond's party, had opposed votes for women. I know you can't get into the secrecy of the ballot booths, but is there any evidence at all, even anecdotal, that basically the women were waiting in the long grass for Redmond and the Irish Parliamentary Party in 1918?
That's a very good question, actually. It's a short term. My answer, I don't know. I've never seen it. I see a hand going up there. Maybe I've never seen an attempt made. Maybe it has been, because I'm not abreast of the latest research on a lot of these things, I'm sorry to say, to try and break down between male and female. But it's a secret ballot, so how do you make the calculations there? Let me put it like this. If there were any suspicion that there was a significant difference, I think somebody from whatever side would surely try to point that out.
Right.
That's what I would say, but maybe not. I'm quite open to correction or amplification.
Your question there,
Well, actually, I was just going to comment on that. Rosemary Cullen Owen quotes John Dillon, who, of course, was really in charge of the party at that stage, as being a ferocious misogynist and saying that if there were votes for women, that that would be the end of civilization as we know it, and so on. And I think Redmond had much the same feeling about them. The way that women are spoken about, of course, is always paternalistic, or in the case of Markovitch, I believe that they were disturbed by her beauty and they couldn't actually hack it. It was too difficult to be in the same room as her. And of course, Yeats did great damage with his rubbish because he didn't understand women.
Right. No, well, something that's been discussed in Red, I don't have the Countess hog the discussion here totally, but there's one aspect of her character is the fact that she converted to Catholicism as a result of an epiphany during the Rising, apparently, but formally the following year. Yet, I just want to go to this iconic thing. You know, there were posters during the Repeal the Eighth campaign, you know, of the Countess, Repeal the Eighth, right? And Mary Kenny has a provocative little piece in the current issue of History Ireland, actually, basically suggesting that, you know, the Countess mightn't or wouldn't, you know, have supported Repeal the Eighth. I know we're talking about time travel here, right? What I'm talking about is the appropriation of iconic figures for other agendas. Anyone, any comments on that? I mean, is that legitimate? Is that fair game? I mean, I also saw Peg Sayers in a Repeal the Eighth.
Oh, Peg Sayers.
I don't know how she managed to smuggle her way in. But, you know, the point I'm raising is, are we investing, you know, kind of whatever you're having yourself in some of these historical figures that maybe isn't appropriate? Dear, have you any views on this? Like, particularly if you're teaching students, because they're obviously absorbing what's happening now, and yet you're trying to teach them to take an objective approach to, you know, the historical Countess Markovitch as opposed to the iconic Countess Markovitch. How do you deal with that?
I'll approach it from another angle, if I may, Tommy, and this might seem shocking, but even at this stage, students are saying to me, enough about Countess Markovitch. Mm-hmm. Surely there are other women, or whatever. So without denigrating her too much, but there were other women. You know, there were other people who are the untold stories of Irish history. So I'll answer your question that way, if I may. Of course they revere her, and who couldn't but be impressed, as you say, by her own propaganda, you know, by the images that she portrayed. But young people today, and I only teach girls, I've never taught boys, but so I can only say from teaching in a single-sex Dominican school. But they show great imagination. They can step outside of the present. And one of the key phrases that's in education now is contextualization. You know, that they get it, you know, when actually, you know, you put somebody in context. So that's all I'd say about that, Tommy. You know, that they are interested in looking at other women and other role models.
Can I just make this is not a very profound point, but the second you begin trying to freeze some perspective as of whenever it was, and translate into the present, so to speak, then, how would they respond now? How would they perform now? You're automatically imposing your own perspective on what they ought to have done, essentially. And it is simply unhistorical. You cannot project. I mean, you're presuming to know how some other mind would work. Mm-hmm. And however well you may think you know that mind, you can't come from inside it, and how they would respond to changing circumstances. Trying to impose on somebody how they would work today, how they would respond to something, whether they're male or female, whatever generation they are, et cetera, to me is simply an abnegation of historical judgment. Mm-hmm. You know, you can say, this is the way they responded to the circumstances at the time. Okay, you can project how you think the way that mind worked would respond to circumstances today. But then you have to say, how would that mind have changed? How would it have responded over time? Were they bringing the identical mind that they had then to where they are today, to where they are now? Or would they have modified, mellowed, reinforced, or whatever? So to make that judgment, in my view, is essentially, it may not be wrong, But it's unhistorical as far as the historian, quite historian, can go. Mm-hmm. We impose our own wishes on them. You know,
and I mean, one of the things that we're doing in education all the time now, and I mean, it has advanced so much, Tommy, over time, for the better. And as I say, one of the key kind of buzz phrases is contextualization. But we are teaching them, Joe, you know, the language of history, the vocabulary of history. Yeah. You know, with so terms like, you know, being objective, propaganda, and all of these terms are now, in a sense, the alphabet of how we're actually approaching history in the classroom. So it's a great time to be teaching history.
The one thing, to me is terrifying, but it applies to oneself as well, is when you look at the way historians, the way we change our minds over generations, the way there are new interpretations, etc., etc. And the question I want us to always ask is not so much, the first question we have is not what do I think about that. The first question we have to ask is, why do I think what I think about that? In other words, the first question a historian puts into himself or herself, why am I thinking that way? Right? And so you subject yourself to the most intense scrutiny you can, insofar as any of us can ever do that properly, which none of us ever can, totally. And then is one entitled to make historical judgments.
You see, I think that we're trying to make somebody, trying to see into somebody's mind as to what they would have said or done in a particular situation when you posed the question about the repeal, which you have been an iconic sort of a show me person in that time. I don't think you can do that, because I think overall, when you think of Constance Markovic, what she did, she was the only person, first woman in the whole of the British Isles to be elected. She was the first woman minister. I mean, that is huge. And so trying to, despite her eccentricities, mm-hmm. if she had them, and she had, despite her oddities or whatever, she's that one salient factor overcomes them all. She had that sterling quality which enabled her to be elected, which enabled her to take up her position as a minister in an all-male environment, which enabled her to go out with the gun in Stephen's Green during the whole rising period. She had all those huge qualities which transcend what would she have said at the such and such a vote, you know? Mm-hmm. I think it's so large that it gives her iconic status, mm-hmm. and it's hard to take from that.
Just to move this on a little bit, because Constance Markovic may have been the first Irish minister, but the second one wasn't until Mary Gagan Quinn in the late 1970s, mm-hmm. appointed by the well-known feminist Charles J. Hoy. My question, sorry, Mary, I know you're a fan. But seriously, my point is, what happens, Sinead? We have rediscovered this activism of women, okay, right, in the revolutionary period, right? Mm. Where does it all go wrong?
Okay. That's a big question. I'm going to start off by in defence of Charles J. Hoggy, for starters, because
he did appoint
her, yeah. And he also was the one who had an active interest in issues to do with, gaining welfare. And when he's in health, he does huge numbers of things. He also appointed himself, which they thought was a clerical error, I'm told, when he became head of the Women's Committee,
yes.
Later on, because he could appoint somebody, and then when his name was written in it, they thought that it was a mistake.
Yeah, I was on that commission.
Yes, so yeah, that's it. Yeah. So what I think is interesting, he saw the power of it at that stage, and you can see that happening through all the different issues that were before him, trying to see how they could actually work out how to attain this women's vote and where it was all going wrong. They were all asking those questions as well. But I think, just to go back in relation to this understanding, and I think it's very important, I think, for me to just add in to when you talk about repeal or people's association or people's understanding of women, right? Because, and following on from what was said about Margaret McCurtain, I was the first of the Trojan UCD of Women's History Documents course. Now, this is really important to make the distinction, which was part of my history degree, rather than a member or somebody who came through Women's Studies. And I don't think that if I had studied history the way I did, the where I came through the classic training, and what we're having now a lot is, we're having people write history who don't have the training, mm-hmm. who don't have the training that Joe was talking about, where you have to stop and not go the route of putting a spin or a slant on it, the first-hand accounts. And so the exercises that I've always tried to do is to try and pull up documentation or pull up material that actually somebody else can interpret. But I've had material that I have found, and I have seen things, and again, which I would consider by people who would be considered to be eminent enough, putting the information then out there again with misinformation. And I think what happens a lot of the time with it is you're only as good as the vehicle in which you can put the material forward. And I think that's where the state have been very successful in recent times, because when they digitised the Military Pensions Bureau record, which is a social history of both men and women in Ireland over this period in time, they digitised it in such a way that everything was, so the blank pages were included. There was no selection process, where so much of the material that was digitised previously was digitised with a sort of a subjective look, or was done by the Mormons when they had a sort of rationale, or somebody decided not to include the supplements. So again, I suppose what we're saying is that if we don't stay firm to the training in relation to the projection of the material, and one of the reasons that I also did the exhibition, which doesn't exist yet, of course, as we know, but which will exist, is in order to fix the time frame, to fix the period in time where you've got a factual account of a lists and lists and lists of material and happenings, because what we have in relation to it is a pick and mix. Schools can choose what they want to do, and they put instead of history into the curriculum society and politics. And the new curriculum looks at propaganda, feminist thoughts, the use of the media. But how can you look at the women's story unless you've got the historic record? And that's where I suppose where I'm coming from. So when you have people who are librarians or archivists or coming from other disciplines or coming to history whose training is maybe as a medievalist or some coming through some other avenue, you need to have your basis of an understanding of your politics, your era, and then you can build on the women's story or the other story or the story of children or the story of somebody else. And I think what I'm seeing a lot of the time is gaps in the knowledge, because people in the 50s who left school at 14 or 13 were very, very well read. The Irish press used to serialise books, so if you weren't buying the books, you were reading them in serialisations in the newspapers. And I think, again, we're competing all the time to the sound bites. And even the way I'm delivering the exhibition is pandering to the new generation who don't think, they think in sound bites rather than in linear. And we need to completely make sure that people have their... And you, I think you have it in school, but it depends on your teacher. That's what I was hearing when I was talking, listening to you speak. You're only as good as who teaches you that history and gives you that love.
Do you want to come in on that day?
Yeah, well, obviously it helps if you're a good, informed and well-trained teacher. But to be fair, and I never thought I'd find myself saying this, but to be fair to the department, an awful lot of progress has been made for the better in actually curriculum development. The leaving certificate, so, you know, the teenager coming out now, or a young adult at 18, having done leaving cert history, has been very, very well served and very well trained. So that, you know, it's even hard for a bad teacher not to teach history well, if you know what I mean, if they follow. Let me just give you an example, if I can, just to flesh it out. And you're talking about, say, bringing in the context of women. I mean, the emphasis all the time, particularly saying in the modern course, you can do an early course, but most people do the modern course. But I mean, the emphasis all the time is the role of evidence, Joe. It's there all the time that you're looking at documents, that you're interrogating a body of evidence, and the topics, for instance, that are studied. Say, for instance, if we go to the early part in Irish history, you would be, say, looking at, you know, the pursuit of sovereignty and the impact of partition. Now, there's a title for you. You know, that's a very well thought out title, from 1912 to 1949. So students are brought through in a survey history, you know, in the course, so that it's a sequence of events. You follow chronologically the events from, you know, the whole Home Rule crisis right through the First World War, 1916, and then, of course, right through the revolutionary period to eventually the formation of the first law, right, of the Free State, I should say, and then right through to the Declaration of the Republic in 1949. So you're looking at state building in terms of the sequence of events, but you're also looking at it through the prism or through the lens of key personalities and key concepts. And if I was to list the names of women that are studied in 20th century Irish history, if you go through secondary school now, they begin with Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, Countess Markovitch, Isabella Todd, Evie Hone, and it goes right through. Then you know if you go to the next phase of feminism, Sylvia Meehan is a key personality. She's there, you know, literally a key personality on the course, apart from obviously being somebody that we would revere and respect. Mary Robinson is there, and then one thing that I think is a great development in terms of educating the broader picture in history, that we're not just looking at Ireland in a bubble. That we look at it because we have to also study two courses from the European and wider world, and particularly American history. So you would be looking at the kind of the parallel world of what's happening in America, and therefore you study people like Rosa Parks, you study Betty Friedan, you're looking at youth culture, you know, counterculture. So it's a very, very exciting time where you're following, as I say, the chronology, you're getting the survey, but you're getting it then through the prism of these key women. So it's a development for the better in terms of the actual curriculum as well.
Can I pull this back to my initial question here, right? Which is, what happens to the women once we become independent, and post 1923, right? Because you have this, I say, you have this amazing ferment in the revolutionary period, and then notwithstanding the people you've mentioned there, right? But they are not the major movers and shakers, like, in terms of politics, right? I mean, they're important in their own way. I mean, why is it, for example, that the bulk of the activist women were anti-treaty? Joe, have any view on that? I mean, is that their first mistake? If you know what I mean, they end up on the losing side.
Interesting question. Maybe they were more idealistic. I suspect depend on personal relations. I don't know about that because I don't know enough about the detail. Or maybe they simply had, how would it, firmer ideological beliefs. Or maybe they weren't as accustomed to compromise as a number of the men were. Or, you know, how do you balance? And I'm not either praising or blaming. I mean, you can take those arguments for and against in all the circumstances. I have no idea how I would have responded in all the circumstances. I have no idea how I would have thought. Mm-hmm. You know, it's easy enough to look back and say, oh, et cetera, et cetera. But how does any of us know how we would have thought in circumstances of a century ago, shall we say? And a lot would depend on what way you came out of, and et cetera, et cetera. So I just don't know. It is very striking how what a high profile the anti-treaty women have.
Yes.
Right?
Well, I always thought the reason why so many of those very active women took the role of anti-treaty, as distinct from those who agreed with it and moved along, I think it is because they became fiercely active, and then they didn't want to drop that. They thought we were on a course now to get freedom, complete freedom in Ireland. And to them, it may be in an idealistic way, they thought the treaty represented a defeat of sorts, which it did, let's face it. They had set off looking for a united one Ireland, and then the treaty, they just couldn't adjust their minds. They had been used to the life of strife and the life of yearning for one Ireland. Now there was no more one Ireland. We were now being asked to adhere to 26 counties. And to them, that was wrong. I think it's just a sort of a straightforward way. They decided they were going to keep forward the flame. Now, that sounds kind of as if I'd been sweetie pie and sort of idealistic about it. I'm not. They were imbued with that idea that we were for one Ireland, and one Ireland meant 32 counties, not 26 counties.
Yeah, I suppose we're back to the same thing again, which is you have to sort of empty your mind of the fact that you know what comes next, and you look at them in the aftermath of 16, and you see the fact that they, you know, cling to the idea of the manifesto, what was the Proclamation of Independence. They see it as an Ireland of equal opportunities. Then they're trying to fight for the reunification of Ireland in some cases, or maybe a better form of government in case of the Friends of Communist Russia. And a number of them went off. Rosa Rosamund Jacobs and Hamlet Heathcote and all of that. Rosamund Jacobs, they went off to Russia to see the sort of different ways of government, and what you find sometimes, and people say, you know, again, it's back down to the saying, you know, is it one political party? Are they trying different things? I mean, you see the likes of Nora Conley O'Brien, when she eventually ends up as a senator, she's actually appointed by Fianna Fáil, but, you know, she'd been involved in various, you know, sort of manifestations of the Labour Party, and again, she'd been in the Republican Congress. So you see them going into different places, and then, of course, you've got this mass emigration from the women who had been arrested during the Civil War, and they leave, and they leave the shores of Ireland, and they don't come back. And then there's the whole notion of where you were going to get employment in the state. And I mean, there's a collection of papers that recently came to light, which is the letters from old Common Imam members looking for work, looking to be cleaners in government buildings, looking to become part of the women's police, you know, literally asking for housing, you know, all those issues, and saying we are the members of Common Imam who fought in 1916, and what is coming, you know, what is to become of us, and they're the ones who stayed. And I think what you're looking at is you're looking at a fragmentation of a society, and I don't think that when you look at where they went politically, they were still political.
And a stagnant economy as well.
Yeah, exactly. But again, where do they put their energies? I think you drop the word politician and you put activist in its place, and you say so they weren't, maybe they were active in setting up a, you know, children's hospital, or they were active in the Red Cross, or they were active in the White Cross in terms of whatever. And so I think again, there's a sort of an interesting look at, you know, the people who founded Fianna Fáil and how they all broke away and where they went to and where their energies were placed in that aftermath of that time. But that's too detailed for here. I think what you need to look at is we have to stop thinking that women weren't politicised, and it could, of course, you can go into the blue shirt and blue blouse movement and think about the hundreds of women who were in that, who then were members of those parties, but didn't particularly take those particular memberships cards out of the drawer or talk about that nature of that involvement. And I think that's to do with, again, we're back to the same thing of where, you know, who's writing the history, and why would the women who were, let's say, in the suffrage movement here didn't end up in politics, even local, or and a lot of them were ashamed of having their parents or their mothers having been in prison, and those things were hidden in drawers. So
Tommy, could
I just want to move things on, because I'm looking at the time here, right? Because obviously women, you know, the sad reality is that they were marginalised in terms of mainstream party politics, but women didn't stop being active, right? Yeah. And I'm thinking here of organisations like the Irish Country Women's Association.
Yes.
I remember as a child visiting my relatives in County Offaly with a farming background, and being brought to the Saturday market, right? And all these women, right? I mean, a massive activity. I mean, I just have this very, very clear memory of this, which always stuck in my mind, right? So you've that, you've the ICA, and then of course also the housewives, the Irish Housewives Association.
Yeah, they were very strong in the 40s.
I mean, how does that feature in the curriculum now, Deirdre? Those organisations that are non-political organisations.
They are, because again, you sort of, as I say, one of the concepts that is a thread now through 20th century is the emerging role of women, whether it's that they were marginalised at certain points, or whether, as I say, they're now getting active outside this political sphere. I mean, as I say, if you take something like the ICA, the United Irish Women, but. You know, these are women who are working, in a sense, in parallel to the state. And that is covered, as I say, within the school curriculum, you know, to improve the standard of life for women. And then, of course, the famous Hilda Tweedy, you know, in the 1940s. I mean, she is demanding equal rights for women as consumers. You know, in a sense, it's almost moving away from the political spectrum. Okay, these are the people in charge of, in a sense, the domestic economy. These are the people who are the buying and selling. These are the people who are making decisions, you know, about money within the home or whatever. All very, very important roles. Otherwise, you know, society doesn't function. So I think there was a very, very interesting kind of almost socialist element, you know, to which you referred to earlier, Sinead.
And they're also dealing with society as they find it, rather
as they find it,
and which I think is important.
You see that with Maureen O'Carroll in particular, where Maureen O'Carroll comes in, a Labour candidate, supposed to just be put on the ticket for the Labour Party to increase votes. She's the housewife's choice. She gets all this voting. Her activism was through letters to the paper, letters to politicians. But she comes into the Doyle and she starts questioning everything. And so she's probably, in terms of the modern world, she's the one who sort of calls a lot of things out in the Doyle. But she also took a court case against the Bachelor's Pea Company because they were putting substandard peas into, because she was involved in what was known as the Lower Price Council. But then she takes this this case, and eventually what the backlash is the factory closes down and loads of people lose their jobs. And so she doesn't end up staying in politics because of her stance, because people want her to stand up for them or talk to them or be their politician when she's doing something for them, but if she's taking on the bigger issues. And so what I think about it is, in the case of the ICA, Fianna Fáil and other parties did look to them for their members. They brought them into the Senate. They tried to get the presidents of that organisation, with the huge numbers of women in the organisation, through into the political process. And they eventually succeed with Kit Ahern. But they can't sustain that through that particular channel of voting and the voting public. And Kit Ahern had brought that organisation, had bought premises in Ball's Bridge. She had modernised the ICA, but then when it's translating into votes and into the political process and into Dáil Éireann, it doesn't really translate. And it's very interesting. It's almost like you can organise a protest, but can you bring it to the next level? And that's where you've got two parallel tracks. And I think what's really interesting when you look back at a lot of the women as influencers to their own children, who end up their sons or other people getting involved in politics, you have a lot of them being very good at the background of putting the electioneering, doing the organisation, but so it's, they don't move very hugely, the vast numbers of them, beyond what they had been doing in the suffrage movement, which was the backroom, organisation, petitioning and all of that. So it's an interesting thing about how many women wanted to stand out and be the person, like you did, who were going to speak up and take the flak of that political life.
Mm. That's true, but there were so many women in organisations. Mm-hmm. We talked about the housewives in the 40s, the Housewife Association. They were very strong in Ireland in the 40s, and then the ICA right through from 1910 onwards, they stayed very strong. But they were quite clear they didn't want to get involved in politics. You know, I know that Kit Ahern, and I know later on, you remember...
Peggy Farrell was another...
No, there was another woman, I can't think of her name, but she became very strong, and she had come from the ICA. But I think somehow within women, in many cases, there's a reluctance to show yourself off, to kind of go up front, to stand up at a meeting. How many times... Would you go to a meeting, if I was to ask in the room now, and you had something good to say, whether it was a school board meeting or a residence association or a political party, and you have an idea you want to talk about, but you're a bit shy about putting it forward, and some fella stands up and says what you were going to say, and they all say, oh, well done, Tommy, well done, well said, and you go home with your big idea locked up in here, and you don't get to express it. I think there's that innate kind of conservatism in women.
Just stand here, Peter. Yeah. Just over the right there.
Is it a woman or a man?
Sorry, Chairman, if I could rewind back for a couple of minutes for the post the revolution and the radical women that were involved in that. And as it was pointed out, quite a significant number were anti-treaty. If I could broaden that by asking the curator, would you agree that quite a lot of them had a much more pronounced ideological view of what the Republic was to be about? Quite a number of them, I believe, did have very strong left-wing pro-trade unionist sympathies and views. Now, following from the revolution, which Professor Lee would agree, some of the men that fought in it said that it was won by conservatives. So post 1922-23, we had a state established which was run by conservative politicians and very, very much dominated by the Catholic Church, which has been left completely out of this discussion, with the role of the oppression of women and suppression of women from the 1920s onwards, right up to and including the era of John Charles McQuaid. And not until 1977, until we had the Equality Act, did women finally get a chance to raise their voice, with the exception of people like Mrs. O'Rourke there, who entered politics. But by and large, it had been more or less ingrained in women from the 1920s onwards. Keep your head down. This society is run by conservatives, but it is particularly run by the Catholic Church, who we know what their attitude was towards women, particularly after childbirth. Thank you.
Now, I was actually going to come to that right at the gap to George, right? It's on my list here. And I want to bring this back to the Countess, which is that if you take her as an example, as we talked about her already, she's a jumble of contradictions. Right? In her correspondence, she talks about the Bolshevik Revolution and Godspeed Lenin. That's a fantastic quote. I mean, there you have it all summed up. Mm-hmm. And of course, at that stage, the Soviet Union, as it became, hadn't become explicitly anti-clerical, by the way, at that stage. So now the point about it is, though, that this thing of the Catholic Church comes up as if it's some sort of a conspiracy, right? But what about the idea that, in fact, that is what Irish society was about? That's what the bulk of people believed in, even some of these revolutionary women. In other words, mixed in with all these contradictions was Catholicism. And then and that's what they end up getting, in a sense.
Can I go back to the discuss. Okay, what's really interesting about it is that some of the women, so Helena Kilcannon, who would have been most prolific of the women writers at the time, who was producing all the books on nuns in penal days, the nuns of Drumshambo, the cult of the Virgin Mary, you know, I could go on and on and on, and I'm including some of those books into the exhibition. And she's also writing about the movement, the Catholic movement across Europe and the organisation. You've got somebody like Honor Crowley, who was the TD for Kerry, whose father was John Pius Boland, who after he ended up out of the Irish Parliamentary Party ended up as the secretary of the Catholic Truth Society, which in case in Ireland would be now what they're producing the pamphlets which we would know as Veritas. And when you see the numbers of sales of those pamphlets at 40 and 50,000, so everything from what is a moral sin, how do I find the girl to marry, how do I become a nun, so you're seeing what the people are reading at the time in terms of it. You're seeing the influences, as I was referring to earlier on, of where people were sent to school. And what's really interesting when you look at politicisation in terms of schooling, and I've actually looked at it in my own case, is I was not educated by an order of nuns who were going to promote anybody into politics or public life. That was not their remit. And so all of that reinforcement, and you can all think about who you were educated by, and it's a really interesting one. So you can see the Loretta nuns who were producing yearbooks for their students.
And they were for education.
They were for education, but they were also about promoting those women who had been in their schools to younger women within their schools.
That's
was a part of what was their ethos early on. So I was really surprised to see these yearbooks and the content in the 60s and the 50s. And then you look at the Dominican, and you can see where their influences are. And then you have other orders of nuns where it's not the emphasis. So the emphasis is into the civil service. It's into nursing. It's into sort of traditional roles. And in the case of the order that I was educated by, they were an Italian order that came to Limerick. But what's important about them is they were about working girls having extra money if they ended up working in a factory. And so again, there's quite a lot you could say about that in terms of the way that I was being programmed and influenced in my formative years. But what I think about it is, and what your question in relation to it is, yes, those women stayed active. We do know that the second Doyle still continued to convene right into the late 20s. There was a very interesting discovery that I made in recent times when Lafayette decided to post up their photographs. You could actually buy a photograph of Dáil Éireann, 1928, which has a group of people sitting in the back of a house in a garden. In it is included Dr. Ada English, Mary McSweeney, Kate O'Callaghan. Does anybody know what I'm referring to? They were still convening as Miss McSweeney's Doyle. And what's really interesting about Mary McSweeney locked into that world, she was living, as my mother would say, on the clippings of tin because of the fact that she was staying outside the state. The same thing with Hannah Sheehy Skeffington. They couldn't remain as teachers, so they wouldn't take the oath of allegiance. And then, of course, we've got legislation that takes women out of teaching, out of the senior civil service, taking out of that. And so you've got that removal of women. And why were the women not protesting against that within the Doyle? Well, again, if you look at their backgrounds, you've got that conservative wing that are not actually going to stand up. They're not the radicals that are in there. They're the people who are coming through the more conservative role. So I think what you look at is that, and then you look at the where you have people of another religion in the Dáil and the small numbers of them. Mm-hmm. And what's very interesting, if you look at the likes of Heather Humphreys in the more recent time, she was actually educated in a community school in Cúthill and Cavan. At a time in the border county, and so she ends up then heading up the 1916 commemorations from this war. And one of the reasons that we have a more complicated or a more complex look at that is because of her own background and her own education. Mm-hmm. So I just think that when you look at that line, it's not a simple one-liner. It's just to try and see, and you're thinking about the emigration and the concentration. And just one last point, I mentioned it when I was giving the walk around the space. I won't call it an exhibition because not at that yet, at the space, and that was that when I went to look at the material that's in the Women's Library in London, and it was very, very sobering, and all of it was in relation to the vigilant groups that were on the quays meeting the Irish girls who were coming, the very poor, not always pregnant or looking for homes, but very, very poor, and they were trying to prevent them from going into the poorer areas in the cities. And they were trying to sort of be there as a sort of a protection force, as it were. And what was very interesting was, what was their decision? Their decision was to go back through, this came through the McNeills in the embassy, and this is back to the importance of primary research. They suggested that the only way that they were going to prevent this emigration flow, is what they were trying to do, of the very poor from Irish into the English ports, was to go back through the priests and the parish community and allow them to have that control of what was happening. And so then you can see the establishment so clearly in 23 and 24 into the fact that it's all been funneled through the convents and the different institutions and back into the where people were going. So what I think about it is it's what I said at the outset and what we said from the end. We have now moved beyond the revolutionary period in some ways in our research, and we're starting to look at the women who may have been more conservative, accepted the state, and we have to move away from the radicals and look at why people were coming forward. And you can find and trace radical mothers and grandmothers, mm-hmm. and progressive men and radical backgrounds and everywhere. And I always think about Garrett Fitzgerald bringing women into politics, and his mother being who she was, mm-hmm. Mabel Fitzgerald, who had been, you know, secretary to George Bernard Shaw, who had been out in 16 but had gone home again, if you remember that story, and that she had been to anti-treaty while her husband had been pro-treaty, and she had stuck, and that's their memory of their mother, radical, opinionated, and so
just to reinforce what you're saying, Sinead, I mean, one thing. And again, I say this as a question as well as just to think about it, that when you think about, okay, the all these radical women and their families and whatever, right up to 1922, you know, what an extraordinary decade it was, say from 1912 to 22. And it was a whole decade that involved uncertainty. Then you get to 1922 and suddenly you're being faced with certainty, if you see what I mean. That you're being now faced with literally state building, with structures. That maybe there was a bit of war weariness, you know, of being tired of the uncertainties of everyday life, and that some women just decided willingly, maybe for right reasons or wrong reasons, but to withdraw and just say, let's just get on with it and wait for another time and let's see how it evolves. But that's just food for thought, you know, from certainty from uncertainty to certainty.
Dude, that just keys up because I'm looking at the time here, right? Yeah. Because waiting for
what
another time.
What time have you got? When do we have to stop?
I'm not sure. I'll decide that. No, I want to move on to so what is it?
2 minutes.
Second wave feminism, right? In the 1970s. And I'm assuming many of the second wave feminists were educated by nuns, including Dominican nuns.
Loretta.
I mean, does that come out of the blue, or is there a continuum? Is this something that comes, is it an external thing because of the international women's movement, or does it have indigenous roots? I don't know, Joe, have you any comment on that?
You mean like the women who went on the
contraception train? I'd be the last person to ask about things like that.
the contraception train. What's your experience of that?
Well, I don't know because...
You were done, I know. You would have read the newspapers, right?
You just missed it.
No. I remember all of that, and I luxuriated in those brave women. I really did. Mm. I particularly loved the little cameos you got when they got off the train at Western Drawers, it then was, or whatever. And they kept ran up to the guard. This is what we were up in Belfast buying, and they were sticking them into their faces. You know, I loved that story. And the guard said, "I don't want it, Mrs. I don't want it."
And some of them didn't even know what they had.
I know, the women, right? I know, the men. Yeah, but no, of course I followed all of that. But I don't think they were a natural. You've asked that question. Were there a natural progression from something that happened? I think there was normal activism in the 40s and 50s, and they were follow on in that train. And then suddenly the stupidity of no contraception became very apparent to everyone, or to most of the women anyway, because they were suddenly faced with, you can't have contraception. You're going to keep on having children, one by one by one by one by one. Wonderful and all that would be if you were able to do it. But why could they have contraception? It's a pure practicality.
Can I just make a point before you answer, just to make a point about referencing and sourcing? In Nuala Fennell's collection, there is a letter from Mary O'Rourke supporting her campaign in 1977 and sending her five euros for her election campaign. Because she stood as an independent. And I say to you that it's what you find are the drawing of the lines and the circles closing. I don't think people come out of nowhere. And I think what Joe has said so eloquently earlier on, I bow before him, is that the idea of the historian saying, why am I thinking this? And there's a great quote they have put on the grave of Anna Parnell, which is, the greatest independence is the independence of the mind. But I'm saying to you, you're the product of your parents, and you're the product of your mother was university educated. And so I'm seeing in you a line that you don't come out of nowhere. And so I think what I'm saying to you is when you look at the level, there's only one woman politician that I could find in all of the women who actually managed to make it to Dáil Éireann who wasn't secondary school educated in a time when it wasn't free, and that is Mary Reynolds, and she's the exception. So everyone else had the luxury of education of somebody who opened their minds. And sorry to interrupt you now, but I just wanted to say that in terms of Mary O'Rourke.
I must tell you about that later.
Just very quickly, again, just
this lady has a question.
Just back to the sources. It's just very, very quick. Just again, I've been teaching in Dominican school for 30 years. I teach in Marcus Park College. And one of the great things that we do, which I mentioned earlier about the census, but the first class that I do with my students in an archives module that they do is to find Muckross. I was telling Honor about this earlier, to find Muckross in the 1911 census. And when they eventually do the detective work and they find Muckross, they said, okay, you can see the names of the nuns, you can see, et cetera, et cetera. But look at the subjects they're teaching. You see the curriculum. And I'd say, are there any subjects that stand out in that list? So the Irish is there, maths is there, et cetera, et cetera. But do you know what's there in 1911? Science and German. Now, I'd say you could name, you know, literally on the fingers of one hand, the amount of schools that were offering teenage girls in 1911 science and German. Back to the Dominican ethos of be useful, be able to be a participant in society, regardless of whether you're a man or a woman. Mm-hmm. And to finish, to tie that up to the present, which obviously passes the 70s and brings it up to the noughties, is the name of one of the pupils there is Halpany, and the last Halpany left Muckross a couple of years ago and did her leaving. I'm just saying there's a continuity there, and you know, as I say, I don't think it is an accident. I think you're right, Sinead, that there is that continuity in terms of certainly people's education.
Get in quick.
Right, I mean, I'm trying to hold on to my train of thought. I was a young married woman in the very early 70s, and what I found very influential was the talk radio, because I was at home, I was looking after children, but you had these, I think was it Liam Nolan had some television or a radio programme for several hours in the morning, so I listened to this as I was doing my sort of housewifely duties, and then you had these kind of ring-in places. Gay Byrne, I think, was quite influential in listening to ordinary women who were sitting at home, and their views got out into the ether, and then other women were listening and they sort of had their own stories to tell. And I think it's gone to the other extreme nowadays. You know, we find out what's wrong with your left toenail. But I think at that stage it was really liberating for women to have a kind of a forum where they were a little bit anonymous, but they could actually speak their minds, and then they found that there was a sort of a fellowship, if you pardon the what would you call it, contradiction in terms, or a sisterhood, you know, that, yeah, they feel the same way as I do. And one other minor thing, when I eventually separated and I tried to buy myself a washing machine, I was told I'd have to get my husband to underwrite it for me. So, sorry, those kind of things, I think, helped to make women understand that, you know, they needed a voice, and the only way to do that was to push other women forward, the likes of Nuala Fennell and all those people who were so supportive, and Monica Barnes.
And they had a tough life for them.
And just make the point that, you know, you know, I would have been a teenager, a young man, listening to that kind of radio as well. So it's not just women are would have been a part of this discussion you just described. But I think it certainly, I'm trying to remember, who is it? The RT, Women Today was the one.
Marion
Fanucane.
And they're in the rain.
But one of the first books that was produced, though, by Nuala Fennell and others was The Change or Change. And chains or change. And what one of the things was to point out to people all of those things that were, you know, the bank manager, you had to have things underwritten. Where people were accepting sort of things as that was the way it was, and there was no wriggle room, or there was no way of doing it. That they began to call out those things, and so then you have the likes of the Labour women's groups set up, and they started to look at it not emotively but with statistics. So they started to produce the evidence around, like, why weren't the women, you know, telephones getting the same money as the men? And you can see the columns in the material that's in the Labour History Society where it's because they're not permitted to plug it in or to lift heavy items. And that's where the money differentiation was coming. And you look at it as a modern person now and you think, oh, that's mad. But then, as you say, in your time, you think, you know, that's the norm. Everywhere you turn, you had to get someone to underwrite you. And sometimes that was the local priest or the local bank manager. And so few people had those access. So a lot of Ireland, as you had mentioned just briefly, was to do with economics and to do with the power of money. And we go back to the earlier women where they were independently wealthy so they could speak out because it didn't affect their job and it didn't affect them in how they were going to be seen by their employer. So it's very difficult for women unless they had some sort of backing to be able to stand up for those small things that were so important.
Can I just ask the panel their view, and possibly maybe Mary, because she would have the background. The period you're talking about from post-revolution to the 1970s, I would consider that would have been a Dev era. And I think Dev was particularly responsible for airbrushing the women out of history. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you as historians would feel about that. The other aspect was television, as the other ladies commented, came in very much. And as we all know, there was no sex in Ireland before the Late Late Show. So, and it brought globalisation, brought other people, other women and other countries to the fore and to Irish women's attention. I would be interested in your comments on those two aspects.
Well, the first question, it's a very good point. Did De Valera brush women out of, or did he intentionally do it? Isn't that what you asked?
Yes.
I think he did. I just think he did. And it wasn't from being a male and wanting to be controlling everything. It was his nature. He was, I mean, he left Sinead, his wife, for, as we know, for years and years. She just kept having her children and minded them and bringing them up beautifully. And he would come back and visit her, and the result would be another child. But seriously, he did very much not see women in public life. And he, I mean, the 1937 Constitution and that clause in it that we're all, well, I personally feel is all very wrong, in which he patronises the eminent role women play in the home and the good that does the country. But just nothing about it. I think that he very much, that was his nature. Now, he was very kind to everyone. I'm just in the middle of David McCullough's second huge compendium on De Valera, and I'm amazed at his kindness to women he had, and to his wife in other ways, but it wasn't his nature to see that, like, you see, we're judging him now, as for now, with women out everywhere and in everything. In his time, not. But I do think he definitely did airbrush, whether consciously or unconsciously, women out of life a lot.
I tell you, I could hit this one first because you've been in before.
Now, that's a heresy, of course, for me to say. But
this will be recorded on our website.
Sorry, Honour. I just wanted to just go back on something that Mary touched on about the reticence of women. It is true that women are very reticent. I mean, I'm wondering in the election of 1918 how many women newly enfranchised supported the 17 women that went for election. We don't tend to be very supportive of our own, unfortunately, women. I feel that. I also feel that talking about the 70s, I had my first child overseas and I came back to Ireland in 1970. I'd had a cesarean section, so I couldn't have another baby. I was told don't have another baby for 3 years. My baby was 1 year old. I knew I had to have contraception, but I couldn't even go to my own mother to say, ma'am, I need to do this. So I think women have to, we can't put the blame on people like De Valera or the patriarchal society. Women didn't support women, or women still don't support women. So I think when we finally realise that as women, that we have to get out there, we have to stand up for our rights and not be afraid, not be so reticent, as Mary pointed out.
Can I just throw something maybe to you, Joe? Like, what's the international context here? We're talking about context, right? I mean, are we peculiar, or are we pretty much, is this the same everywhere at this over the period we're discussing? I mean, the women in France didn't get the vote in 1945.
Yeah,
I don't think we're exceptional in the sense that I don't even stand out, let's put it like that. There's a variety of experiences across different European countries, etc. But the one thing I would say, back to what you were saying, Mary, about Dev and women, I wouldn't disagree with you, but he's simply inheriting what came before. There was no women in terms of the previous 10 years, the first 10 years. All it is continuity, basically. In that sense, he's representative of an entire generation.
It's not as if he's imposing by decree.
The other thing I would say, very brief, and I hope I'm not sounding too sort of academic, is that if we look at the background of the treaty and the immediate result of it, it's often said that sort of the treaty established Northern Ireland. It didn't. Northern Ireland was established before the treaty. Northern Ireland was imposed by the British government before the treaty. Northern Ireland Parliament was in existence before Dáil Éireann. There was an election in Northern Ireland before the Dáil elections, so that in effect, the 26 counties is what's left over after the treaty has been imposed. Now, you can talk about the rights and wrongs of this, I'm not bothered about that. I'm simply talking about the realities. That we tend to assume that there's somehow that was an open playing field for us to decide what we were going to do, etc. The people making the decisions then, you can agree or disagree with them, etc., etc., they were making them within very tight constraints on their room for maneuver. It's not as if here's a list of options and you choose whichever you want. They were told what they could have. And if you don't choose these, they will be imposed on you. Because we've got the guns and you haven't. Simple as that. You can go back through all the constitutional invocations you like about British this and British that and British the other thing, etc., etc. And I'm not even saying it was necessarily ultimately the wrong or bad, worst possible decision for Ireland, because any alternative you can think of could well have been worse in terms of what happened. We had a civil war rising up. Ultimately, if it hadn't agreed originally, who the hell knows what would have happened. So I'm making no judgment there whatsoever. Except if you're in the eye of the storm, having to make decisions under enormous pressure, with effectively a gun pointed at your head. But anybody who took decisions there, and there may have been a whole negative motive, there usually are in human relations, could probably have brought up a justifiable sort of situation. The other thing I would say, because we're from women in a way, there must have been a female majority in the June 22 election for the pro-treaty position. There simply must have been. There is no way the arithmetic adds up if there wasn't. The anti-treaty position was a distinct minority position. Right or wrong is a different matter, but in terms of the votes cast, that's that. And that continued in a way, probably until De Valera was able to establish Fianna Fáil and begin moving towards it. Now, the anti-treaty IRA got a very respectable vote in the 1923 election. The 1923 election was imposed, there had to be an election within 1 year of the treaty. And they got, I think, for the 44 seats, correct me on that, maybe one or two out, but not more than that. Cumann na Mhéill only got maybe four or five seats more. And the rest is spread out among, labelled it very well, farmers. We don't think of farmers' parties nowadays. There were 10 or 12 farming representatives, and there was a number of others. So that you have a you have a massive majority, a 2-to-1 majority, by the pro-treaty parties, right? But divided all among themselves, but it meant that Sinn Féin had no chance whatsoever of getting in. And that was, of course, what started De Valera on his manoeuvres. And if I may say so, there ain't no better man to manoeuvre once the idea got into his head. But it took 4 years. It was 27 before they got into Doyle, and we all know the way he got into Doyle because the Bible was shifted from one corner of the room to the other. And such as you know, he's not taking any oath. I'm taking no oath, I'm just signing a bit of paper. And from then on, he played a blinder in terms of party politics. Again, right or wrong, I'm taking no position on rights of these things, but we're here talking about as if there was wide open freedom of choice. And a majority of women must have supported the treaty in the elections. If they supported them, remember, and this is where we tend to forget as well, 1922 is not 1918. There's been a massive slump between 21-22. So if you're voting as a woman in June 1922, you're looking at a situation where the idea of Northern Ireland is way up there, etc. What's going to put bread on our table? How's our family going to respond? Okay, the church, yes, the church has a position, etc., etc., but the church had positioned previously and withdrew from them under public opinion. Circumstances have changed dramatically. We're not talking about 4 years of remaining constant between 18 and 22. We're talking about very shifting economic circumstances. And if you put yourself in the position of a voter going out who has to think about his or her and her family or kids, etc., etc., if the resumption of immigration, remember there was virtually no immigration during the war, you begin getting rapid resumption of immigration to America from 1920-21 on. Right? The 20s become, again, a renewed immigration decade. The 30s slump because there's no jobs in the States.
Yeah.
Right? We're talking about a very modulated, a shifting situation. And we have to, if you're going to think historically, and this doesn't mean to say you've got to agree with the decisions taken, but to think historically, we have to put ourselves back into the position of the people taking the decisions in the circumstances they are confronting at that particular time. And not, at least as far as I'm concerned, not say they ought to have done this because this is what I want would have preferred to have happened. That's all I say. I'm sorry for something so didactic.
Can I pick up on something very small, but it evoked a memory in me. When you said that New Defence Papers, they had kept the letter I wrote to her. I remember, I can see myself sitting at the kitchen table. I was a Fianna Fáil councillor at the time. And I remember admiring Nuala Fennin so much. She was in the public eye and she was doing things for women. And I remember sitting down and saying, I'm going to write to Nuala Fennin. Mm-hmm. And I gave her a fiver for her election campaign. I know it seems very little now, but maybe it was a lot more then.
It was.
But I can vividly remember writing the letter. And I wished her well in her campaign. And I said, I admired her. I think I said that. I love what you're doing and I follow you all the time. So women did follow women. Just to speak, somebody had that point there about did women do things for women. But they talked about Monica Barnes and Nuala Fennin. I vividly supported Nuala Fennin and always did her when she was in the Dáil and then I was there too. I just thought she was a very fine person. a really good woman who did things for women, and her party didn't come into it at all. She was independent that time, but then she became Fine Gael. But I didn't worry. I just admired her as a woman. You know, it's amazing.
Sorry. Just a few snippets. This is going backwards a little bit. When the guys were going in to set up the First Oil and under its original constitution, family lore has it that it was Count Plunkett who reminded them that they were under the 1916 brief and had to accommodate women because they were going to just forget that as they went into the First Oil. So even at the very beginning, I think revolutionary women were well aware that they were going to be pushed out with the new government. And in the 1920s government, the Cumann na nGael government, three pieces of anti-women legislation were passed. And even Jenny Wise Power, who had stayed with the movement and had been with Anna Parnell in the late 19th century, had to leave at that stage because it became obvious that women had no place and were going to be pushed down. The second Dáil actually met until 1938, and the premise there was that most people in Ireland, and I think this is fairly true, didn't really know what a republic was, and that included the politicians. They hadn't defined it, and they hadn't investigated what it meant for Ireland itself. And just finally, I saw my mother, who believed the only way you could achieve anything was to be a surrogate man. She was a professional woman. And then late in the day, she became a terrific pro-feminist and feminist herself. And I also had the privilege of serving on one of the first juries. And it's extraordinary to think that it took all that time for women to get back onto juries, having been cast out in the 1920s. Thank you very much.
Now, question at the back? And just bear in mind, guys, we will be wrapping up shortly, so if you have anything to say, now is the time to get it in.
It's more a question than a comment, just in light of what you were just saying there, is how many women went for, it's just something I'm not aware of, how many women went for election in 23 or in 27, or when was the next time that women put themselves forward as candidates in Irish elections?
Can you quantify that?
They come in ones and twos mostly at that early stage, and I think what you have is a lot of they weren't going in through the party selection. So even when it happens later on, for Mary Ryan is wanted locally in Tipperary when her husband dies in the 40s, then she's not supposed to be selected by the party. But they push her locally. So what it is it was very hard to get to the selection process that happened later on, right through the period. So they come through in ones and twos. What's really interesting about some of the women who came in through the widow's vote, as they said, from when their husbands died and they took their seat, somebody like Joan Burke ended up, you know, topping the poll locally for many, many years, but she's not really even well known as a name. She was a Fine Gael politician.
Roscommon.
Because she was very much working for constituency work, and they didn't tend to make it into the media, and they didn't tend to get any sort of platform there. Just to the point that somebody said earlier on about the influence in Ireland, one way I always make myself come across really old to my children is that I grew up, you know, right through into the 80s with one television channel. I mean, we didn't even have access to BBC because I was in Limerick. So I think what it is in Ireland, while yes, there's European, you know, parallels when you think about Ireland, is it's really how focused we were on national radio and a national line, and it is very much that sort of insular look, even into the 80s. So I just wanted to make that point about the media, but also the interesting one to look at Eamon de Valera as well is the fact that he was returned home to his grandparents in Limerick, and his mother, you know, remained on in America, that in terms of him and his personal circumstances, his mother was in America for economic necessity, and he's been brought up. And I always think that you can imagine when he was in Limerick, and again, the sort of same things that happened, how influenced he must have been by how he grew so tall. He would have stood out all the time, and he didn't have his parents when he was growing up. So I think when we talk about anybody, it's very interesting, and my interest is always about biography, is to see where things happen to them to make them make decisions later on.
And I think history shows he did feel
an outsider
from the beginning. Yes,
Joe, you wanted to say something?
Well, just the only comment I want to make. We're talking about politics all the time, and the role of women in politics.
I mean, a crucial variable, a crucial factor, is simply women in the civil service. And there were none, virtually none, until very, very, very recently at senior levels. There are a lot of women at a very junior level. It's only very, very recently that women have begun to get close to the top of the civil service. And until that happens in a much more sustained way, you're not going to get anything like total, what I would regard as, I was going to say fairness, but let's just say equality of opportunity. And that is at least, so what's happening in education and what's happening with the very significantly higher proportion of girls now getting on to third level, I think is a game changer. But by definition, it's going to be a slowish game changer, it'll be a generational game changer. But it's certainly going to transform the next generation, the potential of what is, quote, gender equality throughout the country. But until that happens, politics alone in a narrow sense is not going to be able to determine it.
Can I go to Jeremy for the last word on this right there? Because you're at the coalface teaching female students. And what's your sense of their feeling, like of where they're at, right? I mean, of their ambitions in life?
They see the world as their oyster. They do not see limitations. If anything, in fact, maybe in some cases they'd like to achieve them without maybe having to do some work along the way, but that's probably a typical kind of teenage thing. No, but seriously, I'll give you one small example. When the repeal of the Eighth, that whole episode in Irish public life was dominating, I remember on the Friday, my students sitting in front of me in their green uniforms at Veritas and Dominican uniform or whatever. And then when the actual count came, I remember looking at the television screen, and there on the screen was Lisa, one of my sisters, now in a black T-shirt with Repeal the Eight, celebrating in the square there in Dublin Castle along with the rest, and not a bother on her. She was not an exceptional woman. I think she was very, very, as I say, when I say average, I don't mean that intellectually. I mean that she is very much representative of young people today.
Yeah.
And to me, that kind of encapsulated, said, my God, we've come a long way. Mm-hmm. So hopefully maybe that will just kind of crystallise. There's confidence. There's, of course, endless opportunity. They're being educated at a time where there are all kinds of options. But it's great to see them making use of it and being themselves and seeing, the great thing is about seeing possibilities, going back to the Dominican education, seeing possibilities all the time,
right?
Not limitations.
Well, listen, I'm going to wrap up on that positive note. I just have to thank, but first of all, I want to thank the Department of Culture, Heritage and the Gaeltacht for their financial support for this event. I'd like to thank the people here in Dublin Castle for the facilities they've given us, and our panel, in particular Sinead, to showing us around an exhibition that does not yet exist.
And we're all longing to see
which took quite a bit of...
I did that to you as a great favour. They wanted to cancel it because we weren't available, so I said I could actually do The Emperor's New Clothes for you, Tommy.
Yes,
so that's why I did it. So
I'm looking forward to actually seeing the exhibition itself. Mary O'Rourke, in particular, Joe Lee, and Deirdre McMahona. I'd also like to thank you, the audience, particularly those people who made contributions from the floor. Now, just to let you know, next Hedge School will be taking place in Ballyshannon, which is my hometown, by the way, just coincidentally. That's happening tomorrow week, Saturday the 10th, and we're going to be looking at the 1918 general election. And another one then, following week then, as part of the Dublin Festival of Books, The Great Hunger Reassessed, and that will take place in the Dublin Port HQ on Alexander Road, 2:30 on Saturday the 17th of November. So I hope to see you, maybe some of you, at one or two of those events. Thank you very
Tommy,
much.
Tommy, I have one commercial.
Yes,
one get commercial. It in, get since it we're in. Talking about this is one last speak. I don't know if any of you were listening a few days ago, but there's a launch from the Minister of Culture, Heritage, and the Gaeltacht about the great sort of investment for Heritage Ireland 2030, and one of the parts of the plan says the following. It says, Heritage Ireland 2030 will recognise the vital role our heritage plays in our community, our economy and our society. And here's the commercial. History is now being marginalised in the curriculum at junior cycle level. And if they want to be able to celebrate with the community in the future, you have to teach them history.
Yeah.
So therefore, our history and our heritage. So put history back in the core curriculum. Sinead.
Thank you. Thank you.